This is the Epilogue audio experience.
Film is clearly a sophisticated art, possibly the most important art of the 20th century, with a rather complex history of theory and practice, writes James Monaco in his book, How to Read a Film. So far in our podcast, The Artists, we have had filmmakers, writers, critics, programmers from some of the top film festivals, musicians, thinkers, defining their combinatorial skills. We at Metaphysical Lab have been striving to expand the realm of our podcast, which in turn gives a wider canvas to the understanding of our experiences. And also we have tied up with Epilogue Media, the podcasting network. So you can find us on their website, epiloguemedia.com/theartists. And of course, you can continue to listen to us on the platforms that you choose, from Apple Podcasts to Spotify to JioSaavn to Google Podcast. Everything is mentioned in the description. And of course, you can reach us on the WhatsApp number and our email ID. I'm your host, Suchita, and I'm looking forward to a wonderful journey ahead with all of you. What is thinking, and does it need a language? Does language restrict our thought process? If we did not have language, do you think we would communicate better? Maybe on Twitter. Do we think in language? If I think in one language and talk in another language, how will that affect my brain? This and more on our episode number 83 of the podcast, The Artists, with our guest for today, Veena D. Dwivedi. So Veena D. Dwivedi is a professor in psychology, neuroscience, and director of the Dwivedi Brain and Language Lab at Brock University, Canada. She has a PhD in linguistics from the University of Massachusetts, examining syntactic and semantic dependencies in Hindi relative phrases. Her current research focus is on the cognitive neuroscience of sentence processing using ERPs, which is event-related potentials. And this is going to be an exciting conversation, so stay tuned. Hi, Veena. Welcome to our podcast, The Artists. And thank you for joining in. Thank you for finding time to be on the podcast and share your knowledge of working in language and brain field, which is something very important all of us should know and understand, especially the artists, and how we can benefit from it and realize the fullest potential. So thank you, Veena.
Thank you, Suchita, for having me. It's a pleasure.
You know, Veena, I have always been thinking about this. And before I go on quoting Chomsky, I just want to sort of understand a very basic level in terms of language and the human brain. So when we think, Veena, because if you have your own lab, it's researching, it's innovating on it. When we think, do we think in terms of language? And if language was not there, do you think we would think differently?
So when we think, we do have an inner voice, and that inner voice has a particular language. It is the language of our community, the language that we grow up in. Mm-hmm. Can we think without language? Well, babies don't have language, and they can perceive the world around them. Dogs don't have language, and they can perceive the world around them. Mm-hmm. So language helps us make sense of the world around us, but we can certainly perceive objects and certainly look at them. Thinking is a whole other matter, however. But the research shows that most of our thinking does have an inner voice.
So if we, for example, if we think in a language, suppose if I'm thinking in English, but I am talking in Hindi, or if I am thinking in French and I'm talking in English, do you think that that would impact the way I think and perceive the world and the way I create?
So what you're asking is, if I'm thinking in English but speaking in Hindi, or if I'm thinking in Hindi but speaking in English.
Yes.
So that doesn't really happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so first of all, let's unpack. You're asking actually multiple things at the same time. So that's how I get, wait, how do I even begin to answer this question?
Sure.
You are asking about the nature of a bilingual.
Yes.
That's what you're asking, right? Say, hey, you know, so when a bilingual person talks, where is their other language? Okay?
Right.
So, right. So right now, Suchita, you and I are speaking with each other.
Mm.
I happen to know that you are also a speaker of Hindi, as am I.
Sure.
And it's you know, so I can tell you that I told myself before this interview, I said, okay, don't switch to Hindi. Don't switch to Hindi. because many of the listeners would not be Hindi speakers.
Yes.
So what that means to say is if I, as a speaker, know you, and I know that you share a language, that language becomes activated.
Mm.
So then it's activated and relevant. But I know I'm thinking in English. The work about bilingual says that the languages are always there, and context tells you which language you should be using and when. So for example, years ago, like this in the 80s or 90s, at McGill, they showed that even babies, so French-English bilinguals in Montreal, there are many of them, and a baby knows which language to use depending on, so when the baby's in the lab, if the experimenter is a Francophone, speaks French, the baby knows, oh, I'm going to use more French words here. Or if the experimenter happens to be an Anglophone, an English speaker, the baby knows, oh, I'm in English, speak English. So the context is what determines which language gets used.
Right, right. But you know, tell me, if I go to France, for example, I learn French and my first language becomes French.
Yeah.
Do you think that I will create and perceive the world differently?
But see, but there's a very important confound there, right?
Right,
the
right.
Confound is you're living in France.
Right.
That's confound. So the thing is that so language is never separate from context. So I go to France. Maybe I don't like snails. Okay, but then I go to France. Everybody's eating snails. I go, oh wow, this is great. Whereas 5 years ago, I would never try snails. So now I've changed because I like snails. So yeah, I've changed. But did the language make me change, or did living in France make me change?
Mm.
Every language has a cultural context. There is no such thing as language without culture. So
right.
Any changes that people think happens because of language, I would say, yeah, that could be a piece of it. But the big piece is people are what change us.
So the language is nothing without context. But if there was no language, Veena, how does the brain interpret that? How does the brain, what kind of signals come out of the brain when we use a language? Like right now we're talking, but what if we don't use a language? If there was other means to communicate, like the computer has a binary code 0 and 1, how does it interpret that?
So how do we function without language? Okay, so number one, that's difficult to answer because every human brain, a property of a human brain is that it has the capacity for language. What we know is that when there's some kind of an accident, compensatory, people can compensate and can work around not having language. So that's like, you know, how do blind people function? They don't have the ability to see, but they work around it. Other senses kick in and they're able to function. So if we look at people who don't have language, or our difficulty to communicate. Again, where do I begin? Are you talking about children?
Maybe the deaf guys.
Okay, so children who are deaf do have the capacity for human language. They can learn sign language.
Hmm.
So just because your auditory system doesn't work, there is the human brain has a capacity for syntax, for semantics, for meaning, and meaning that is derived from a particular structure. And that's what syntax is. So not only that, so children who are deaf, who are born to deaf parents, and if they learn sign language right away, and it, they become quote unquote native signers. And if we look at which brain regions of sign language participants, if we look at which brain regions are sensitive to grammaticality, it's the same brain regions that light up for English speakers, hearing English speakers, and for deaf signers.
So we know there are 7,000 languages, and we have 86 billion neurons, is what the internet is telling us.
Right.
So, and also the internet is telling us that the language is located in the human brain, which is Broca and Wernicke. Correct me if I'm wrong. How does it decode? How does language get decoded in the human mind? Is it binary numbers like 0, 1? What is it? Neural networks? What is their final output of it?
So every single one of your questions, five questions in them, and every single one.
I just have 35 minutes, you know, but let me pack everything in.
How does the human brain decode language? Is it a 0, 1? Well, the quick and dirty answer is nobody knows, Sujitha, nobody knows. And if I went to the 0, 1, that's reminiscent of how neurons work. Either they're firing or they're not firing. And yes, there is a network that is involved. The best known network that is involved in human language is the Broca Wernicke's network that is connected by the arcuate fasciculus. So that's a massive white tract that connects Wernicke's area, which is in your posterior temporal lobe, to Broca's, which is in your left frontal lobe. So that's that. We've known about these areas for about 150 years. So Paul Broca was a French physician. He was doing rounds, and he found this patient called Tan. The patient was called Tan because that's all he could say was Tan, 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 Tan. And because Paul Broca was a physician, upon the patient's death, he did an autopsy, and he found a very massive lesion in the left inferior frontal gyrus, which is called Broca's area. About 15 years later, Carl Wernicke discovered a patient who could talk a lot, but made no sense. And that's a part of the temporal lobe. So, and Wernicke actually talked about the connection between the two areas by this white tract called the arcuate fasciculus. And that's where we've been for 150 years.
Bilingualism has a strong influence on the plasticity of the brain. So is it that if we, as creators, as artists, as people, learn two or more languages, it's going to sort of help us in terms of our creativity?
There are, again, so many ways to answer this question. Let's first start with the science.
Hmm.
So I'm well aware of the science. In fact, I was in the audience when I heard the very first, not the very first talk, but it was the mid-2000s that this research was coming out. And the research was looking at monolinguals in Canada and comparing them to bilinguals in India and China. And I said to myself, when I heard the talk, I'm like, hang on, Toronto is not New Delhi, is not Shanghai. So I went up to the speaker and I said, how did you control with your bilinguals? And she said, well, we controlled for socioeconomic status. And I said, listen, somebody who owns a car and a house in Toronto is not the same person who owns a car and a house in New Delhi. So the problem with studying bilingualism is it's very, very hard to, like in science, when we make a comparison, it's all about the control. It's all about how alike are these two populations. They should be very, very alike, because when you talk about the difference, you want to make sure it's about that difference and not something else. So there have been these protective factors about bilingualism. I've never believed it because, the human brain is ready for language. Being multilingual is not special. It's not special. But a lot of our thinking about how language works, you mentioned Noam Chomsky, has emerged out of North America. And North Americans, this is a new continent, only a couple of hundred years old. And so it's, wait for it, monolingual. Okay, the rest of the world, where people have been living side by side for thousands and thousands of years, guess what? They speak more than one language because they're stuck with each other. Multilingualism is actually easy for the brain from birth, okay?
Right.
The facts change as you age. So this idea of the research is showing, guess what? There is, and I've always questioned these data, but the science behind the protective factors of bilingualism and say Alzheimer's, very weak, sochita. Now, let's come to the second part of your question, which is, should I learn a second language to help me become more creative? Absolutely. Why wouldn't you? Because every time you learn a second language, you get to talk to somebody you didn't talk to before. And when you talk to another human who lives somewhere else, speaks a different language, and you try and understand that human, you learn something new.
Right.
That's why nowadays everybody says innovation, it's all about diversity. Absolutely it is. Because if you talk to same old, you get same old, same old. You want to learn something new? Talk to somebody else. What's a good way? Learn a different language, talk to somebody else from somewhere else, and then you will learn.
Right. So it can impact our perception in terms of not just talking to somebody else, but if I'm in a room alone, mm-hmm. looking at the internet or perceiving something, my own understanding of the world, perceiving the smallest thing, like even an ant moving on my wall, do you think a second language can make me see something else?
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned to me, prior to this chat, that you were reading on literature that was saying that, Mandarin people look at time differently.
Yes.
I've never been convinced by those data either. If you look at the data, people whose languages define things differently, let's say my language has terms for light blue versus dark blue. Yeah, yes. If you put me in a lab and you say, Vina, you got to press a button for light blue versus dark blue, and my language has words for that and your language does not, I'm going to be faster because my language has a name for it. Does that make me different than you? And let me, by the way, you know what the differences we're talking about?
Right.
If it's a button pressing task, the differences are like maybe 200 milliseconds. 200 milliseconds? That's a fifth of a second.
Right.
In the lab, you can tell, this group is different than that group. Okay? But we're talking on the order of a fifth of a second. So it makes... It's very sexy to say, you speak one thing, I speak something else, you're not the same as me. It's ridiculous.
Right.
The human brain is the human brain is the human brain. I can always understand you, even if you speak a different language, even if you have a different experience, if I'm willing to listen.
Right.
Go on quick, to go beyond, to use Daniel Kahneman's work, thinking fast, thinking slow. So yes, we can always just quickly make a quick judgment, light blue versus dark blue, quick, bam. But what's the inference there? The inference should not be, you're different than me. The inference should be, if you do something every day that I don't do, you're going to be better because you've got more practice than I do. That's it.
Right.
That's big news about different languages.
Okay. So this TED talk of Lera Brodesky, which I had mentioned, 7,000 languages in 7,000 cognitive universes. And she's like a professor of cognitive science at the University of Cal, San Diego.
Yeah.
Where she was talking, I'm sure you've heard the TED talk, where she specializes in the relationship between language, brain, and a person's perception of the world.
Yeah, it's really sad. One of my thesis advisors was Ken Hill.
Right.
And Ken Hill lived with Walbury in Australia. And this is so 90s, Suchita. But in the 90s, nobody talked about tribal people as being different than us. It's all like, look at the cool syntax. Whoa. But then 9/11 happened and, America was under attack. Everybody's different. This divisiveness, it's everywhere now. And it's even infected science, where 200 milliseconds is made into a big deal. It's not.
Right.
So that it used to be that people, linguists used to laugh at this stuff. But now it's like, it's the answer because, if you can make a bar graph, it's real science. When you look at a difference, yes, there are statistically significant differences between somebody who says light blue and dark blue versus somebody who just says blue. So what?
Right.
So what?
Right.
That's just practice. So, for example, also, okay, so other research shows that, you know, Mandarin speakers, their languages are tonal, right? So if I say, so some languages make different words by adding different syllables or morphemes. So I can say dog, I can say dogze, okay, to make it plural. Other languages can make a tone. And this is not actually, so other languages, so I don't know the morpheme for plural, but anyways, other languages define meaning differences by tone. So ma versus ma. So I've got that all wrong, but I'm just explaining the differences. And guess what? Mandarin speakers, they're better. They're better at perceiving tonal differences. Should that be so surprising if every day that's what they're doing than English speakers?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know it's not sexy stuff, but the truth of the matter is that's really different. The truth of the matter is we're better at stuff that we do on a daily basis. And if I'm doing something on a daily basis and you're not, you know what? In a lab, so you thought, and I'll be better than you because by 200 milliseconds.
Right.
So right. It should hardly be surprising, but it makes for very sexy copy. And all of science happens in a cultural context. You know, we like to think of scientists as these neutral people, but there's no such thing as neutral. There's no such thing. Look at the research on older adults, right? So there's this idea that, oh, older adults go into cognitive decline because they have difficulty naming, right?
Right.
Remembering people's names. Hang on. Right. So then Harold Bion about 5 years ago said, it's not about, so the difficulty in naming is, if I'm 20 and you're 60, you've got 40 years of experience that I don't have. 40 years, okay? So right. If I know, so the example I give people is my daughter was home over Christmas break. We were going out to dinner and I said, I have a perfect necklace for you. And I went into my jewelry drawer. I couldn't find the darn necklace because my jewelry drawer was packed. It was packed with stuff.
Right.
And then I said to myself, so then I gave up and I found her something. I had another necklace in another drawer, okay, which I could find. And the thing is, when I was 20, you know how many necklaces I had? Two. One for my boyfriend, one for my mother. That was it. Now, after so many anniversaries, you know, I just have so many. I have so much jewelry now with age. And so it was more difficult for me to find that necklace. Is that because I'm impaired? No, it's because I have more stuff thanks to age. Similarly, older adults, when they go and find the name Susan, when you're 20, maybe you know two Susans. When you're 65, you might have meant 30 Susans. That search space is so much more complex. It's harder to find that name. So again, when we look at differences, how do you interpret them? Kind of got off topic there, but anyways.
Right, right. And you mentioned on your website, Veena, in terms of, let me just quote the website address, which is the way the Brain and Language Lab, which can be found on the internet.
Yeah.
You mentioned this, Veena, on your website, that grammatical structure plays a role in sentence comprehension. Do you want to sort of elaborate on that?
Right. So that was just, you know, I know you said you wanted to talk about Chomsky.
Yes.
So he had a very famous sentence, which is colorless green ideas sleep furiously. Okay, colorless green ideas sleep furiously. Now, that sentence has no meaning. You can't, ideas don't have colors. You can't be green and colorless. If you sleep, it's passive. You can't be furious if you're sleeping, right? So that sentence has no meaning, but it has a syntactic structure that every English speaker can recognize as English. On the other hand, if you say sleep green furiously, ideas colorless, you're like, what? That makes no sense. It's the same words, but they're all mixed up. And they don't conform to the rules of English. And so we know that you can separate syntax from semantics. That is, you can separate sentence structure from word meaning. And that is the focus of my work. Where do you have structure and where do you have just word meaning? It's a very tough problem, actually. So right now, so for example, there are certain brainwave patterns. So you mentioned my website, I look at EEG. So right now you're alive. And so your neurons are firing and neurons use electrical activity when they fire, which produces an electrical field, which you can measure as far away as the scalp. And certain brainwave patterns have been associated with word level meaning, and other brainwave patterns have been associated with sentence level meaning. But how do you differentiate context that is derived from word level versus context that is derived from the sentence? Tough stuff. So that's what I'm working at. Anyways, so when I said I'm looking at grammatical comprehension, right, I'm looking at syntactic structure, but I look at everything. I basically look at syntax and semantics. That's been the focus of my work.
So again, when it comes to writing, like you're writing a book, you're writing a script, your syntactic structure mm-hmm. of what you are writing. Mm-hmm. Do you think, you know, if we understand in depth of how that's affecting a person's brain or a mind, the readers, do you think we can change the way we write, the way we think we write?
So you're asking if I'm writing.
Yes.
Can I change the way I write?
No. If I'm writing and if I know how that's impacting the person's brain, can I change the way I write to make it more impactful?
I think you're drinking the Kool-Aid of it's all about the brain. It's all about the brain. You know, it's such a that it's all about the human.
Right.
It's all about the human. Mm. So think of the context that human is in.
Mm.
And tailor your message for that human in that context. Because you are your brain. Your brain is not separate from you, okay? So does my work impact writing style? I doubt it. Because that stuff, we already know that. We already know that. You know? Listen to the human. Pay attention to the human. The brain stuff that I look at, these are questions that are, you know, quite refined. I mean, in terms of day-to-day impact, I mean, I can go on and on about that, but that wasn't your question, so I don't want to get off topic.
Do you think, Veena, that artificial intelligence that's sort of taking prominence is going to change the way brain and language is being thought of so far? And do you think it's going to be different when it comes to AI, or it's going to be designed like humans?
Right. So here's what I have to say about AI and machine learning.
Mm.
So I think, you know, the technology is getting better and better.
Right.
But that technology is not mimicking what humans do. So the example I give is birds fly and so do airplanes. Okay? They're both flying. But the technology by which an airplane flies is not the same technology as a bird. Airplanes don't flap their wings. They don't, right? So really, I'm an ornithologist and I'm not an aeronautical engineer. Aeronautical engineers are super smart people, but they're not interested in natural phenomenon. So AI, God bless them, but they are working with very different principles than people like me, who want to know how the human brain works when it comes to language. So do I think, I guess that's pretty much my answer. So when we think of AI and talking and speaking and listening versus human talking and speaking and listening, the right way to think about it would be airplanes versus birds. Natural principles, biological principles, they're both flying. Different fuel, different technology, but they both have the same outcome of flight.
Right.
You know what? You're going to get an outcome at some point, perhaps, I don't know, where there might be robots talking. I don't know. But those principles are not the same principles as human beings speaking and talking.
So the brain of a robot that they are saying is going to be better than and faster than brain of a mind, the fundamentals of a human mind is not going to be applicable in terms of language comprehension as well to the robots.
Yeah, I'd like to find, I don't see a robot being faster than a human brain.
Right.
In terms of speech comprehension, I doubt it.
Right.
Because, well, the rate of speech is determined, right? The rate of speech, that's going to be so I'm talking at, I think I said that earlier, that in a second, the average speech is, 4 to 5 syllables in a second. So most words are 2 to 3 syllables long. So in a minute, there's 100 to 130 words. The robot brain can't possibly work. If it worked faster than that, what would that even mean?
Right.
It can't work faster than speech production. Maybe it's true for other stuff. I don't know. But for language, that makes no sense.
So repeating my earlier question, should we as artists have proficiency in another language?
Anytime you have an opportunity to look at something differently, you should go for it. And language is a great way to do it. When you speak somebody's language, you connect with them in a very particular way. And it's always worth it to do that, because you will hear their story in a different way. You will have more access to somebody else's point of view. That is always enriching. It's always enriching. So I'm a big fan of multilingualism. I'm multilingual myself. Okay?
Right.
But what I'm saying is that I know it's true. I think there are massive social benefits. Every time you have a social benefit, there's an emotional benefit, which is good for your brain. So, there's no question. Looking at the broad strokes, dare I even say common sense, it's good for you. Okay?
Right.
So that's Veena. That's Veena, the thinker talking. Veena, the neuroscientist talking, says, I think the idea is right. I'm not sure about the science so far. Those are two separate things, right?
Right. Sure. Totally. Yes. So it's going to, in the context of communication and social skills, is where it's going to, broaden your horizons, and also in terms of understanding the culture, which is, again, communication and perhaps perception of, things and creativity in the world around you.
That's right. And every time you learn, you change your brain. Every time you learn.
Right.
You are enhancing, you are investing in your brain health.
So that's it, folks. So I hope you're keeping track of the festivities that's happening the world over, which is the film festivals, and a lot more things, a lot more events happening out there. And of course, the world is trying to come back on its feet with regards to the corona wave, but it's not going anywhere. We are still in the midst of it. So take good care of yourself. And as always, count your blessings.